Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Mayor of London debate hosted and organised by the LSE London School of Economics Question Time Society. We're just waiting for a couple of radio mics to come upstairs and downstairs, and we'll start in a minute. First of all, we regret to inform you that Stephen Norris, the Conservative candidate for Mayor of London, has had to at the end will be standing in his place. Also, Chris Eubank won't be speaking, who initially organised it. Chris Eubank has asked a friend to sit in his place, Tim McCarthy, who's a businessman and Londoner, so he's pretty good at this anyway. Okay, I would just like to quickly run through the format for this debate. Remember, this is your question time, and I'm sure you'll agree this is a fairly rare opportunity for you to debate directly with your future Mayor of London. We encourage all of you to take this chance to make your voice heard, and if you'd like to ask a question, or express your view, or even just make a comment on an issue raised, then please put your hand in the air and keep it there, and someone with a microphone will come to you. You can ask questions on anything, Mayor of London issues, wider issues, whatever you want. Have the radio mics arrived yet? We've got downstairs.
Oh, it's starting at the radio mics. One's up there, look.
You've got one there, okay. Is that it? One up, that one down, is that it? Two. Is the one on there? Okay, fine. Right, let's go. Okay. Can we come up with a question which has been sent to us via email in advance? Has the force. Sorry, of course. First on the panel is Susan Kramer, to my left. She read PPE at Oxford before living over in the States for a period of time. Back in the UK, she was candidate in the 97 general election and also at last year's European elections. She runs her own business and is a Londoner through and through, and she's currently standing as the Lib Dem candidate for Mayor of London. Next along we have David Putnam, a highly distinguished film producer whose Oscar award-winning work has included Bugsy Malone, Chariots of Fire and The Killing Fields. He was awarded the CBE in 1983, received a Knighthood in 1995, and was made a life peer in 1997. He's also an LSE governor. To my left is Ken Livingstone. He joined the Labour Party in 1969 and is the former leader of the GLC. He is the Labour Member of Parliament for Brent East since 1987, and only yesterday he announced that he will run as an independent candidate for Mayor of London, and now faces expulsion from the party which he says he loves. Welcome. To my right is Tim McCarthy, I've already introduced. Next along is Frank Dobson. The Labour Member of Parliament for Holborn and St Pancras since 1979. He became the Secretary of State for Health in 1997, a post which he held until last year. He's also a former LSE student and now an LSE governor. He is currently the official. He is currently the official Labour candidate for Mayor of London and the preferred choice of Tony Blair. Welcome. And at the end, finally, is Bernard Jenkin. He's a Conservative Member of Parliament for Essex North and is currently the opposition frontbench spokesman on transport. When in government, he was a member of numerous parliamentary select committees, and today he's very kindly agreed to stand in for Stephen Rice at short notice. So can we start off with a question which has been sent earlier to us by email? Has the farce which we have witnessed in selecting the candidates for the Conservative and Labour parties not tired Londoners of a whole mayoral contest? And is it not a hint at the fiascos which London will have to face once the mayor is elected? Ken Livingstone.
Well, I should start by actually saying that at the moment I'm not actually a member of the Labour Party. I woke up this morning as a letter on the mat from Margaret Madonna, the Labour Party General Secretary, saying I am now suspended. So I suppose for the first time in 31 years I'm here above party politics. I have to say I think the Labour situation has been a complete fiasco. But then if you start out with the idea that there's one candidate you have to stop and you'll devise any set of rules in order to do it, it's likely to be rather messy and difficult to explain to the public. I think the most revealing thing about the fiasco is that it seems to me that the fixers who were behind all this assume that all of you are so stupid you wouldn't notice what was going on. And the only way you can explain such bizarre behaviour is from that perspective. Nobody would seriously have set out to do this if they thought people were going to be aware of just how venal and transparent it all appeared. And I hope out of this comes a lesson. Because I actually still will be going out in a year or so's time urging people to vote for another Labour government. And I will work to get another Labour government. And I want to see that government continue with the work that's already been done in devolution and beginning to rebuild our welfare state. My arguments are about degree and timing and how much and how often. They are not some fundamental schism that I want to see this government brought down. But when I watched the Welsh election results come in a year ago and the collapse of the Labour vote by 17%, I remember thinking to myself, well, at least they won't repeat that mistake in London. And they have. And a lot of people said to me in the last 2 weeks, if you let them get away with this, they'll think they can get away with anything. What you as Londoners have got over the next 8 weeks is the chance to reinforce one basic democratic principle. You, the voters, should determine who represents them, not party bureaucrats and not rigged electoral colleges.
Susan Cramer, is this whole fiasco going to put Londoners off the whole contest?
Well, I mean, it's already put Londoners off in a whole series of ways. I've been walking the high streets in London. People were rather enthusiastic back in September about a mayor. But now they just come up and, you know, they're very cynical and basically say, you're all just a bunch of politicians. Nobody's talking about us and nobody's talking about the issues. And I think that actually matters to people. But could I say, I think what's happened is probably we're starting to see the beginning of a really genuine fault line in British politics. I don't think it's accident that the Labour Party's torn itself into two. The Tory Party is tearing itself into two. And I think we're starting to see a change, this notion that because of 100 years of history, you have a sweeping umbrella party that basically takes people from the very far left over well into the right, and you can all have them in one party, and they're all going to feel that they have a voice. I think in a way that is over. And we'll be looking back on this in 5 or 10 years and saying we're actually seeing a sea change in the way that politics is managed. But if I do have a plea, it's this. Could we get away from the celebrity, the personality, and please talk about issues? Because on May 5th, what will matter is how the mayor and the GLA are actually going to change your lives. We have different ideas in what you do about the tube. We have different ideas in what you do about transport. We're all approaching the issue of safety and crime in a very different way. I'm out there talking a lot about reinforcing our different communities, building up deprived London, and getting, you know, sort of jobs back into communities all across this city. It's all getting drowned out, and whoever gets elected will not have a mandate unless we get to the issues, and you'll have 4 years of chaos, 4 years of farce, and 4 years of complete ineffective waste. So please, let's force this one back onto the issues and end the farce. And if we don't, I hope Londoners revolt and vote against everybody that they feel has played a part in this process of making London a laughingstock. And I say that as a Londoner. I have pride in this city. Let's, for goodness sake, bring pride back into this election.
Tim McCarthy, what do you think?
to some extent, I'm in a slightly more privileged position here because I'm here representing myself, Tim McCarthy, as opposed to a political organization or any particular philosophy. I think that as a Londoner, my concern would obviously be that whoever is elected mayor on the 5th of May is somebody that ultimately is concerned about the issues that affect London, that at the end of the day is a Londoner through and through, ultimately somebody ideally that has his roots in this city, and somebody that can tackle those problems head on. Now, you talk about a fiasco, the fact that the Labour Party has somehow fallen apart or it has had difficulties in essentially trying to decide which way it was going to go in terms of its candidate. My own feeling is that to some extent the best situation would have been for individuals to be standing as mayors over and apart from party representation. That if at the end of the day we were able to choose the individuals on their own merit as opposed to the parties that they represent and all that goes with that, then we're much more likely to get somebody that is the right candidate for this great city.
Bernard Jenkin, are the Tories tearing themselves apart?
No, we've had one member, one vote. Admittedly, we had to have a rerun our selection. But we did so for the very best of reasons. We resisted the temptation to fix the replacement. We had one member, one vote again. And I think Mr. Blair should learn the lesson that if you try and devolve power, you shouldn't try to hang on to the process by rigging elections and rigging selections. And if there's one really significant thing that comes out of the chaos in the Labour Party is that that nice Mr. Blair doesn't actually control the Labour Party. It's in a state of chaos and revolt. And the control freak is in fact a failed control freak.
To that.
Frank Dobson.
Well, as somebody who decided to run to be the Labour candidate when everyone assumed that it was going to be a one-member, one-vote ballot, I was confident that had we had a one-member, one-vote ballot, I would have won it, and I remain confident of that too. But I have to say, listening to Ken's warm words about his concern for the Labour Party, it does rather remind me of the warm words he used to issue at every meeting, every hustings that Glenda Jackson and I and he went to, and then he used to end up with the words, and I can give you a categorical assurance that I will not stand as an independent candidate if I am not selected. But I think the thing that people ought to bear in mind is that the reason Ken wasn't selected under the Electoral College was because out of the 57 Labour MPs in London, he could only get the votes of 10 besides himself, and he couldn't get the votes of a single one of the Labour nominees for the Greater London Assembly. And that shows that the people who knew him best trusted him least to deliver on reducing crime, improving the transport system, and securing more jobs for London. What it basically shows is that people who know Ken best trust him least.
Surely all... Surely all the votes from the MPs were because if they didn't vote for yourself, then they would have been kicked out of the party, were they not?
Well, I mean... two points. First of all, all 10 of them who voted for Ken have already said they're supporting me, some of them rather vehemently, because they believed him when he said he wouldn't go separate. And the other thing is to suggest that they all voted for me because they were trying to further their careers. I don't think Bernie Grant was trying to further his career by voting for me. I think he thought I was the best candidate.
Ken Livingstone, before I let you answer this, actually, yesterday Tony Blair said, I passionately believe he, Ken Livingstone, will be a disaster for London.
Well, that's surprising because when he invited me down to Chequers two weeks ago, to discuss what I would do if I was elected mayor. We had a very pleasant 50 minutes whilst my nephew and niece wandered around the grounds and did a bit of vandalism. And I ran through what I would do, the sort of people I'd appoint, and he seemed to be very reassured. We didn't agree about the funding of the tube, but I don't think we disagreed on anything else. Now I turn on the television and apparently I scare him when he goes to bed.
Lord Putnam, will Kenilworth be a disaster for London?
Start off with what we want. I'm a Londoner. I spoke at the original meeting at Central Hall, which I think started the entire process in the mid-90s, that led to the fact we've got a mayor today, so certainly my commitment to the mayoral process is absolute. But I'm concerned about a number of things. Number one, I think the process of constitutional change we've gone through in the last 3 or 4 years has been important, probably been over-hurried. I don't think it was thought through as well as it might have been, and we're now dealing with a lot of the repercussions of that. We're seeing it in Wales, we're seeing it in Scotland, but we have to do that. In order to get these things through, and certainly in order to get them through in a single term of government, you have to take a certain amount of risks, and you have to an extent, clear up the mess afterwards. I feel the same way about Europe. We ought to go into Europe, and we ought to deal with the problems of Europe after we're in it. But anyway, this is where we are. I've got two problems. One is, as a teenage splitter, that is to say someone who left the Labour Party, in the 1980 and returned in 85. I know what it feels like to be disillusioned. I know what it feels like to reflect on that. And I know what it feels like to go back. I also think that you've got to understand that the Labour Party has a race memory, very recent race memory, of what chaos is. Quite interesting that Bernard just said that the Labour Party is in chaos. He knows that's rubbish. It is not in chaos, but it has a very, very clear memory of what chaos feels like. And if you get an overreaction, and to an extent I would agree we are getting something of an overreaction from leadership, it's because they're desperate, and rightly desperate, not to go back to the late 70s and early 80s, because we know what amount of pain it caused and what amount of chaos it caused, and because it kept us out of power for 18 years and gave you, whether you want it or not, gave you a Tory government. What I'm principally concerned about is that nothing Ken does, and I don't for one moment think he would do it intentionally, that nothing Ken does, nor this overwhelming desire to punch the present government in the eye, has the net effect in the spring of next year of delivering you what you don't want, which is a Tory government.
Susan Cramer, will Kenilworth Easton be a disaster for London?
Well, I disagree with Ken on a whole series of things. I mean, we agree on the principle of the tube, and as I've said to Ken, I was very glad when you finally came over to support our bond issue, having voted against it in Parliament about 9 months ago. And there is unfortunately quite a history of that, of changing positions, but I'm glad when finally people change over and come and support Liberal Democrat positions, long established and as formal party policy, which is keeping the tube in public ownership and using bonds to fund it. But may I give you an example of where Ken and I do disagree. I want to do bonds very differently. Ken wants them backed by government guarantees. I want them to stand alone because that brings financial discipline to the tube. And I've also argued for changing management. Now people say that's finessing it, that's boring stuff, that's detail. But it's in the detail that you actually deliver what people are looking for, which is an effective change in a system that actually works day by day. So if I look back at the GLC and Fares Fair, interesting to cut fares, but it was the beginning of the end of proper investment in the tube and led to the collapse that we actually have today, a system where the escalators don't work and where there has been all kinds of deferred maintenance. And the system isn't functioning for Londoners. So my feeling when I look at Ken is that can you actually deliver it in a way that works in the end, tested over time and over years? And that's where I think I can deliver this. And it's going to mean building consensus. Take again that tube issue. You're going to have to work with this government and make it change its position. Now, I can do that in tough negotiation, but we're going to have to end up with a consensus. And to build a consensus, you've got to be somebody who comes to the table able to bring people from very different positions together and still allow them to walk away from that table with some sense of ego. That I'm very afraid that what I see as I look forward, Ken is 4 years of prize fighting. And that gets us absolutely nothing, because in the end, what is going to matter is what is delivered for people who live here. And that's why I really feel there are broad differences between us in a whole range of policies, But fundamentally, building a consensus, bringing in all the parties, making sure people work together. And at the end, somebody said to me, what would be your greatest achievement? And I think it would be at the end of the term to step down from office with people turning around and saying, you know, things work in London, but wasn't it easy? That's because you would have kept it out of the headlines, made it happen. This is an executive role. This is not a headliner role. This is making things function for people in the city.
Frank Dobson.
Well, if we're going to talk about the modernising the tube, let's accept that the Steve Norris contract to extend the Jubilee line is 2 years late, it's still not working properly, and it's cost at least £1.5 billion more than it was supposed to. Had that been financed by a bond not backed up by the government, then Londoners would be having to dip into their pockets to find that £1.5 billion excess cost of extending the Jubilee line. So we need to be very, very careful about how money is raised for the underground. It isn't just a matter of what sort of interest you pay on the money that's borrowed. The real test is what is the ultimate cost of getting the work done. And if you're going to have cost escalations of 40% and 50%, then that wipes out any gain from borrowing money cheaply. At the same time that the Jubilee Line extension has been such a disaster, the extension of the Docklands Light Railway to Lewisham, which was a public-private partnership and therefore tied in the sources of finance with the contractors, and both of them knew that if they went over price it would be their money, not the public's money, that has been built on time and to price. And so I believe it's very right and proper that we should look very carefully at the idea of extending the PPP approach to modernising the underground. But I don't say that that will necessarily be the means of financing every project. It might be, for instance, that a couple of the modernisations would be PPPs, whereas the Crossrail project, a new line from Paddington out to Stratford, might be funded and contracted for in different ways. But what I believe we've got to do is to decide these things on a pragmatic basis for each scheme. What would be the best and safest deal for Londoners, and go for each of those and not rule it out on ideological grounds. And I must say, it's very unusual to find a Liberal saying that she would rule all other things out on ideological grounds.
Thank you. Didn't hear... Can I just argue? You didn't hear me say I'd rule it out on ideological grounds. I come at this as a banker whose role has been raising money for large projects. And I think it's crucial that when you have a monopoly like the Tube, it stay in the public sector. I don't want the fragmentation and the sort of misdirection that has happened in the railways brought onto the Tube system. And the discipline that you talk about, and you point to the Jubilee Line as a bad project, and you're very right, was because we didn't have decent management brought into the Tube. I intend to change the management. And we didn't have decent contracts written with the people who did the construction. When they overrun under a sensible construction project, they take the additional cost. You can achieve what you want without having to give up ownership control of the Tube to the private sector. And okay, that's exactly the point. And I may say, by financing with bonds which are half the price of the other schemes, we can keep fares down.
Bernard Jenkins.
Well, whatever the shortcomings of the mainline railway, the investment's doubled. You've now got talk about bullet trains, 150 mile an hour tilting trains. None of this would be happening if it hadn't been transferred to the private sector. But what the point that seems to be missing here is that, in fact, Tony Blair has already ripped the Tube out of the London Act. None of the candidates are going to have anything to do with the public-private partnership on the Tube, because Mr. Blair talks about devolution, but then doesn't trust the people he is devolving to, and that's why you're in this terrible mess. because he's going to fix this so-called public-private partnership on the tube, which is now more than a year behind schedule, in a state of absolute chaos, with bidders pulling out of the race because they have no confidence in the process. And then he's going to hand over this done deal, if it ever gets done, which I must say, that the real shortcomings of this is digging deep tubes and maintaining a clapped-out tube system is an extremely risky business. You cannot just simply transfer the risk to the private sector in a contract. Anybody who's done up their own house knows that the builder always runs over the contract and you're left paying the extra bill at the end. And the reason why the Jubilee Line extension went over budget is because the only way you could let the contract is if you kept the risk in the private sector. That's why wholesale transfer to the private sector is the only way forward. But all you candidates are living in cloud cuckoo land, pretending you're going to fix the tube when Mr. Blair's already fixed you.
We'll take some questions and comments from the audience just in a second. Just before we do, Lord Putnam, can you make a quick?
Yeah.
I think the biggest fear, and what we should all address if we're going to get a lot out of this particular session today, is knockabout politics is fun. It's a lot of fun. The people who love it are the media. They sell more newspapers. They constantly got stories. The problem is that those stories will ultimately be at the expense of London. London will become what gets knocked about. I work around the country, and there's a lot of jealousy and envy and misunderstanding of what takes place in London, and believe me, there are other regions in the UK who would be only too pleased to see London take a dive. So all I would beg you is enjoy the fun. Ken is a terrifically charismatic and interesting politician. I think it's great in many respects that he's standing. I wish he wasn't, but he is. but please understand, Susan put a finger on it. This is a management job. It's about getting you to and from your place of work. It's about making London a better, easier, more pleasant place to live. That's management. That has nothing to do with knockabout comedy. And that is the bit that the newspapers are not interested in. They're not remotely interested in managing the job. They're interested in personality politics. And Susan's correct. If you get sucked into that, you're going to do yourselves and London a massive injustice.
Thank you.
There's obviously been a lot of talk about the tube and things. That debate has been done quite a lot and will no doubt be done more. But this being a student event, I was wondering if the candidates were prepared to listen to London students and follow the lead of the Scottish devolved parliament and abolish tuition fees, the top-up fees, for students in London.
Can you repeat the last bit?
If the candidates were prepared to listen to London students and abolish the top-up tuition fees for students in London and London students going elsewhere.
Thank you. Susan Cramer.
Well, absolutely, yes. As you probably know, that's Liberal Democrat Party policy. I would very much like to have a system like that, frankly, in Scotland. One of the things about devolution is you have the opportunity for one part of the country, in a sense, to almost lead the way for other parts of the country, and this is a lead I would like us to take, though I recognise Scotland has the right to choose a different system, just as Wales or Northern Ireland would have the right to choose a different system. Can I say, to me, it's just a real anomaly at the moment that English students studying in Scotland can't have the same opportunities as Scottish students, that both to have an opportunity for grants and will have to still pay fees. So I would very much like to go in that direction. So we've supported it for years. We need more money for education, and that, you know, continues to be a fundamental policy. There's about to be an income tax cut in April. That's a one penny in the pound. How about we all oppose that and put that money into public services, because we need it, whether it's education and health and other public services for this country.
Frank Dobson.
Well, the answer is no, I wouldn't oppose the government's policy. Unlike some of the other candidates, I actually do try and tell the truth and not just suck up to whichever audience is in front of me, if you see what I mean. I believe that, difficult as it is, the government's policy is right, and the shifting of money that's been permitted to further education to people who are more in need, generally speaking, than people in higher education is a shift in the right direction, however unfortunate that may be. And when Susan Cramer talks about the famous penny on income tax that the Liberals are always talking about, The trouble is, I mean, you hear about people spending a penny, but the Liberals do it time and time and time again. And they do it for about 23 different purposes, and a penny won't go that far.
Bernard Jenkins.
Well, it's interesting. What, not only is the penny being promised, but also something that's within the power of the London Mayor is... it's not within the power of the London Mayor. The London Mayor is going to have nothing whatever to do with student fees.
That's right.
And you know, the danger of this election, it's going to be get hijacked by a whole lot of issues. What you want is a mayor that's going to be the police critic, but be the police's strongest supporter in order to get crime down in this country, because crime's gone up by 25% in London, violent crime up 25%. What are you going to do? I mean, are you really going to elect somebody who failed to get the waiting lists down when that's what he promised to being elected and will be Blair's poodle? Or are you going to elect somebody... Or are you going to elect somebody who won't support the police, but he will support the terrorists? We are... Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Or somebody who won't support the commuters, but he'll support the unions. Or somebody who won't support the city, but he'll support the rioters. That's what you're being offered. That's what you're being offered by Ken Livingstone.
Ken Livingstone.
Well, I don't know if any of that was directed at me. There is a clause in the bill that says the mayor will have no powers over health and housing and social services and education matters. And I think if the mayor works and sorts out transport and brings the police into the 21st century and gets a new relationship going between them and Londoners and starts to tackle some of the unemployment problems with the very limited powers the mayor's got through the London Development Agency, I think then the next Labour government will devolve further powers to the mayor, and it will become the pattern of regional government for England. I believe in regional devolution, therefore I want this system to work. So the mayor won't be able to do anything about your grants. All I say is that, I mean, I thought it was bizarre watching Labour MPs troop through the division lobbies to introduce tuition fees and not reverse the end of student grants when we have all had free education ourselves. It seems to me our job should have been to try and defend what we had had for future generations to come. And the best way of actually paying for further and higher education is a more progressive tax system, so that people don't have to worry about paying while they're actually getting their education, but as they make money in later years, they contribute back into society that way. Because many people who go through further and higher education and then go into education work, social services work, health service work, will never make great fortunes, but they'll have to pay the same amount back for their education as someone who goes into the city and might come to expect a £100,000 bonus every Christmas. I just would like to see the reintroduction of the idea of a more progressive tax system.
Thank you. Questions?
Sorry, just to talk about the police that's just been raised and issues about race. You talked about being a critic of the police, because I've been hearing recently, Frank has been saying how the police have got to get tough, but he's not said anything about how we're going to change the police to make it more aware that a lot of Londoners are black and ethnic minority members, and the police have had an image of being very racist over the past few years. And I'd like to know what the candidates would do about that, and also the fact is, I mean, is it not an insult to Londoners that of the 25 GLA members, the Labour members selected, hardly any of them are black? I think you can count maybe three or four on the fingers of your hand.
Thank you. Frank.
Well, it's certainly the case that there is racism and there's also corruption in the Metropolitan Police, and that needs to be rooted out. And in the two meetings that I've had to date with the police commissioner, I've emphasised that we do need him to root it seriously and systematically, set about rooting out the racism and corruption in the Metropolitan Police. And one of the points I'd like to make is this. There's a lot of talk about changing the culture of the police, and that may take some time, but if they're a professional body, you can say in some senses, well, while they're getting on with changing the culture, they've got to change their behaviour straight away, and we have to eliminate that racism. But what I also say, we need to bear in mind that black and Asian Londoners are actually more likely to be the victims of crime than white Londoners. And so when I say that I want to support the police in their efforts to make this city of ours safer than it is now for young and old, for men and women, and for black and Asian members of our society, I mean it. I mean it for everybody. And we do need to back up the police. We need to modernise the police. They've got a lot of, you know, some of their communications equipment isn't as good as your mobile phones. We need to modernise all that. And we need to make sure that there is better recruitment of black and Asian people into the Metropolitan Police. And one of the reasons why there isn't is because of the reputation of the police as a racist organisation. That's how it's perceived, and we've got to get more black and Asian people in. And these things can be done, because, can I just say, there were all sorts of criticisms of things I did as the Secretary of State for Health, but during the period I was Secretary of State for Health, when we promised that the boards of health authorities and trusts would reflect the communities from which they're raised. No, but I'm demonstrating what can be done. Then 50% of the people I appointed to those boards in London were women, and 24% were black or Asian, and that reflects the makeup of the London population.
Thank you. David Putnam.
I have nothing to add to this particular question, but I'd like to whip back to the previous one, because I think it concerns everyone in this hall, and it's important this gets said. First of all, we're looking at a situation in which in the past 15 years we've moved student numbers in Britain from 10% to 34% currently. 34% of people, students in this country go to university. That is a remarkable, just think about it, in 15 years, with an ambition to reach 50%. It's an incredible increase, and it has to be paid for. There's no question in the short term or medium term it's created tremendous financial strains. I'm not for one moment going to suggest that student fees are the only answer, because they're a very blunt instrument. I also think it's ridiculous to feel that we can't evolve over a period of time to a situation in which people who opt to go into what we might term the academic world or public services get absolutely full fee release. But I'd also say something else. Most of the people in this room will end up earning 10, 15, 20 times the national average wage. Why is it that in this country, where for years and years and years you had free education, I include myself, free education, we have no history whatsoever of alumni endowments of universities? Yet the United States, which has paid education, has massive endowments from the people who benefit from that education. So I would suggest to you, the problem may well start here. If you are prepared to say that in the rest of your life, the high earners will massively endow the institutions that taught them, I'll go into battle with you and try and reduce fees. But if you really want to think you should walk away from university and have no further influence or responsibility to the system that funded you, then I'm afraid I'm not prepared to help you.
Bernard Jenkins.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to the gentleman's question in just a minute, but I'll just make this point about student fees. The fees that are collected from you in this hall by the London School of Economics is sent straight to the Treasury. It doesn't go into education. I mean, the government has established a completely cockeyed system of student fees, and if people are angry about it, and if you want to go down the American system, they charge the lot. I mean, if you're suggesting that we should have an American-style university system in this country, you're going to charge for the whole tuition fee if we're going down that road, which seems extraordinary. You should use that example. But the point about the question that was asked, Steve Norris's watchword about law and order and the management of the police is respect. That whether the policeman is black or white or Asian or whatever, he's got to have respect, he or she has got to have respect for the public, and the public have got to have respect for the police. That is the relationship that Steve is pledged to build. And you cannot build that relationship when the police are under such strain and actually having to cut police numbers in the face of rising crime, which is what has happened for the last 3 years under this government. So what we are pledging is that we will restore police numbers, we will engender an atmosphere of respect between the police and the policed, and that means you need a mayor who is going to be the sternest critic of the police, but also their strongest supporter. And you find throughout the ethnic minorities in London, and I'm a Londoner myself, though I represent an Essex constituency, throughout the ethnic minorities in London and throughout the whole of the population. That is the situation that the people earnestly desire. That means training the police, that means recruiting the right police, but it also means encouraging an atmosphere of respect for the police amongst the population.
Thank you.
Can I say there are some very practical things we can do to change the Metropolitan Police, and if I could just focus on those for a moment. First of all, you need political leadership if you're going to stamp on the canteen culture, because, you know, while it has some supportive elements, it really is a very dangerous way to try and create your culture within the force, and it's been responsible for the persistence of this sort of institutionalized racism, which is also there in the Home Office, it's in the political parties, it's in the media, it's throughout our institutions, and it's very frightening when you find it in the Metropolitan Police. But I also understand many of the young constables who feel that they have personally been singled out as racist when they feel that they are not. And they're in a very difficult situation right now. Can I say what we need to do? We need training. A lot of those policemen need somebody to go back out with them and work out how you do stop and search so that it works in the community. And you're not singling out people because of racial stereotypes. And that kind of training can be done. And I've talked with police inspectors who have said to me, I wish I had the time to go out with some of my young constables and do this exercise again, but I'm so under-resourced and overstretched, I can't. Now, if you're going to improve police recruiting, you've got to improve pay. That means London waiting. We're fighting for that in Parliament, so please back us. Secondly, you change the look of the police. I've asked businesses, where you have senior Asian, black business people, would you consider seconding them to the police, into the senior ranks, perhaps for a period of 1 to 2 years, to bring in a different culture, to act as mentors, to provide role models? Because if we wait for people to be recruited in and rise up, given the present police career structure, we'll wait 25 years for a change to happen. And then down at the recruiting level, we're not recruiting people in the numbers that we need, never mind reflecting Londoners, partly because the career structure is wrong, partly because of the whole lack of pay incentives, and partly because there's still not the feeling that the police are going through that kind of internal change to be fully welcoming. And we can tackle all of that. So it's going to be pressuring the government for pay, introducing a system whereby senior people can come in from the outside. And lastly, and most importantly, it's working with the communities. We've got liaison committees now talking to communities, bringing the police and people together. But I have to say, if we don't keep on the political pressure, they'll become talking shops and not effective.
Tim McCarthy, just very briefly.
I can keep my responses fairly short because I'm not a politician. I'm probably the only politician,
only non-politician here. Can I just say that I think, you know, as a Londoner, when I hear that crime has gone up to 25% in recent years, that's an extremely scary statistic. On balance, I think the police do an extremely difficult job. It's a job that requires a balance, obviously, between law enforcement, but at the same time, any sort of institutional racism has to be rooted out. Obviously, that has to be tackled, but I agree with what Bernard Jenkin was saying, which is that the government, on the one hand, has to be the sternest critic of the police, but it also has to be its most strong advocate.
Okay, we'd just before we take another question, Ken Winston.
I mean, if you look at what's wrong with policing in London, we know that the reason Stephen Lawrence's killers still walk free is that one corrupt police officer in the station had a relationship, a criminal and corrupt relationship, with the father of one of the killers and passed the information about the progress of the investigation over. Now, the reason that officer continued to serve was that none of their colleagues would give evidence against them. And I've said quite clearly, I insist that the police disciplinary code makes it a dismissible offence to refuse to cooperate with an inquiry into racist or corrupt practices amongst fellow officers. And it does seem to me a higher standard has to apply to police as it does to politicians in society. At the same time, the vast bulk of our police are not racist. They are not, I expect, their problem. The problem is that we don't have the resources to actually tackle crime. We used to have 28,000 police officers in London at a time when we had just over 6 million people. Now we've got 7 million people and we've got 26,000 police officers, and the number is going down. When I think back to my childhood, my idea of wickedness was throwing a rock through a window. because I grew up in a city where a police officer would come round the corner at any moment, and that is what deters crime. I was very impressed on a recent visit to Seattle. They've reintroduced police on bikes who can get around, are seen, are visible. And that is what the mayor's got to have. More policing, but getting the police out and back onto the beat and in the community so that they deter crime. It's no good saying you're going to bang up a mugger for 10 years. By the time the mugger's knocked an old lady over, she may never have the confidence to come out of her house again. It's more important to deter crime. And the sort of the nonsense you get in American policies of hang more, you know, electrocute more, that is defeatism. The real success is to deter the crime in the first place.
The lady in yellow at the top, yeah.
As a pedestrian and cyclist in London, I would like to know what, if anything, you plan to do about the tyranny of drivers in London. And how soon I might expect to feel safe, not from street criminals, but drivers.
Susan Kramer, very briefly, please.
Brief is hard. Yeah, that's the one thing I haven't mastered. Obviously, I'm trying to encourage people to think in terms of public transport. We're willing to use congestion charging in central London, working hours, working days, to encourage people to get out of their cars so that you have to pay if you want to use scarce road space, just as you do to use the tube, the train, or the bus. And I'll let you do it with a travel card so that you can use the tube, the train, or the bus if you've made your payment. And that will help. But we're also going to build into the overall strategy, which is what the mayor can do, is actually build a transport strategy, cycling and walking. And for example, with cycling, I've committed to complete the Sun London Cycle Network, but we need local networks as well. We need to encourage places for people to park their bicycles, simple things like that, that make cycling workable. But segregated cycle paths are absolutely essential, I believe. And also with walking, I mean, we're looking at making pedestrian areas that are much more extensive in the city. If local residents want them, then in local areas, looking at the World Square concept to make more of London a pedestrian area where we can build that in. Because everybody begins and ends their journey with walking. And it really has to be treated as an equal form of transport. And some of it's purely design. I mean, the way we have entrances and exits from places don't tie up with other forms of transport. Or, you know, you come out of a building and you can't walk across the street safely because the crossing. We build it in. We can think of it as an equal form of transport and make a change that I hope will satisfy your needs.
Thank you. Bernard Jenkins.
I suspect you'll find every candidate is committed to completing the London Cycle Network. particularly when you ask the question. The difference is Steve Norris actually launched the National Cycling Strategy. Steve Norris initiated the London Cycling Network, and Steve Norris is committed to cycling. And I expect... I suspect... And just to make the point, I suspect I'm the only person on this panel that actually arrived by bicycle at this meeting.
Frank Dobson.
Well, one of our biggest problems in London is we've got a half...
Did you come by bike?
No, I didn't. I came by taxi because the people who were going to pick me up were late. But our problem in London really is we have a half-hearted commitment to cycling lanes and routes, and we have a half-hearted commitment to bus lanes and improving bus services, and we need to be more wholehearted about it. But I'd just make one point, and that is that the interests of pedestrians and cyclists are not necessarily the same, because there was a good old friend of ours who lived very close to us, who in her 80s, having been an accredited war correspondent in 1943, 44 and 45 with the Red Army, crossed Eastern Europe and entered Berlin, didn't get a scratch. Three times in her 80s, she was run down by cyclists on the pavement.
Thank you. Ken Livingstone.
I agree with everything that Susan and Frank have said and won't bother to repeat it.
David Palmer, you want to make a brief...
Just very briefly. I think there's a big cultural issue here. I've travelled a lot in my life, and what's interesting is California is a car culture, but ironically it's a car culture which was designed to accommodate pedestrians and cyclists. So they're definitely not incompatible. Better example is Norway and Denmark, where you get the sense that everything to do with transport has been designed around the needs of people. And the culture I'd like the new mayor, whoever he or she may be, to take on board is design things around people, not around things or companies or products, but around people. You put people first, the situation begins to explain itself and solve itself.
Thank you. Karine, up at the top.
So far we've been talking as if there's one London and we're saying what we're going to do for London. But to me it seems as if there's two Londons. On the one hand there's London of the City, which is one of the richest places in the world, where there are huge bonuses reaching record levels, where the rich are just getting richer. On the other hand there's another London, a London of poverty, where people are actually getting poorer, where there's crumbling services and things are breaking down left, right and centre. What are the candidates going to do to redress this gross imbalance? Because if you want to talk about the rising crime, it seems to me that the rising crime is actually due to people's living getting worse and worse. What are you going to do about that?
We've only got 5 or 7 minutes, so can you be brief, Fiona Jenkins?
Well, just very. I don't believe that being unemployed makes you into a criminal. And in fact, we've now got rising crime. I mean, it was falling until this government got in, and now it's rising. But even though unemployment is going down, unemployment's going down. And in fact, you're wrong that the living standards, even amongst the poorest of society, is in fact improving. And I think it would be a great mistake if the mayor makes it his job to try and engineer equality. Because equality does not necessarily make a nation and a people wealthier and happier. What you want, what we need in this country, and what we need in this country, and even Mr. Blair seems to realise this, is you need people to be able to come to this country and get rich and stay rich, because the money of the few will fructify in the pockets of the people, to use Winston Churchill's expression, and. If you choose a candidate who's going to go on an equality kick, you'll finish up driving the city of London abroad, which is the mainstay of London's prosperity.
Tim McCartney.
My view is that I'm torn between the fact that the city's obviously a major revenue earner for the country. It brings a lot of prosperity. The benefits of that are basically not only shared by London, but by the economy as a whole, and it's vitally important to this economy, full stop. I think, therefore, that to some extent, to try and equate what's going on in the city with other areas, other deprived areas of London, is not actually comparing like with like. I think the ideal situation is that the prosperity of the city should be encouraged, but that some of that benefit should be able to pass on to other parts of London, whatever way that's possible.
Thank you.
Well, can I just quickly say that I talk with businesses the whole time and with the city, and I don't think they would live with either of the two statements we've just heard. That now you find businesses talking about how terrible it is that we have social exclusion. So you've even moved away from where I think most business is. We have a city that is dividing itself into a ghetto of the rich and into a ghetto of the poor. We've got 13 of the 20 poorest communities in England are here in London, which many people outside do not recognise. And we have to take on that challenge. If you can't make a difference there as mayor, you might as well not be in the job. And what I talked about is, you know, one of the reasons I'm walking every high street in this city is to say that every part of London counts and is important. We can do a great deal through the regeneration budget to begin to turn that around, because regeneration doesn't have to be just making houses look nice. It's putting in training facilities, health opportunities. And you can use that regeneration budget. I've also talked about community banks, so we can rebuild businesses and jobs in communities that people can access. And let me say, I find business wants to be a partner in that. It does not accept the views that I just heard from the so-called Tory.
We're running a bit, so we're going to have to end in a minute. We've got 1 minute. Can you half a minute?
Right. Can I just say, there is a change in the city. Judith Mayhew, the political leader of the city, is in a completely different style and approach to predecessors 20 years ago, who really didn't want to engage with the rest of the city. And she's got involved in helping and assisting the poorest boroughs around. And what you have to say is that a lot of businesses need to do more for the city that they live in. they don't go out of their way to look for and help to develop local people, to help them get the skills to work in their firms. Far too many of the firms in London haven't got the sort of equal opportunities policies that allow black people to be adequately represented in senior management virtually every major firm in London does not have a race profile that reflects the city in which they operate.
Well, that's a different
Summit
a
is
different
absolutely
comment.
Disgraceful.
Change your tune, Ken. You
Summit,
said they didn't
Summit
have
is
equal
absolutely
opportunities.
Disgraceful.
You said they
like
didn't have
British
equal
Airways, when
policy.
British Airways in the top 80 senior management staff, only one is black. Now, that was told to me by the one black man, senior manager in British Airways. So I suspect he may be true.
Thanks. And Frank Dawson, do you mind us all?
Well, we've got a very strange city because it's phenomenally prosperous, and some of its industries are the leading industries in the world, including financial services. And in a way, that's all the more reason why the grotesque poverty and deprivation in other parts of London, some of them very close to the city, are altogether more shameful. They're bad for the people concerned, they're bad for the economy of London because the people concerned are held back and therefore can't make the contribution that they'd like. And they're a shameful aspect of this city, and we need to put additional resources into those areas, and in particular we need to get jobs into those areas. And if we're going to get jobs into those areas, we've got to train people better for the jobs that are available. But having done that, we've really got to deliver. And in particular, if you're black or Asian and young in this city, you're twice as likely not to have a job. And that must be wrong. And in Tower Hamlets, where a lot of young Bangladeshis have worked hard at primary school, worked hard at secondary school, gone on to college or university and got a degree, it's the highest proportion of graduates without a job. And there ought to be a lot more effort by the city, which is literally next door to Tower Hamlets, to be going out there and deliberately setting out to recruit those young people from the deprived area, which is literally next door.
Thank you. I'm afraid we've had our time and people are trying to get in. Thank you very much to everyone for coming, and sorry to all those people that couldn't come in, obviously. And thank you very much to all the panel for coming and speaking. Thank you.
Good to meet you. And you, good luck,
Can I ask the audience, can the audience please remain seated until everyone has left? Like the speakers and everyone, please.